That reminds me of another story by Gail D. Irwin, Yahshua Publishing, Post Office Box 219, Cathedral City, California, 92235, phone number 1-888-321-0077. Well, let's read this first. As with my other story book, these stories are true. Most of them happened to me. Some of them came from trusted sources. Each story has a point to it or points. Now, some will tell you more about me than I really want you to know, and some have an edge to them that's not the usual bent of the stories I tell. However, I have chosen to tell them because they can save you some disillusionment. However, some are intended to disillusion. I believe that maturity is being disillusioned and handling it properly. All of these prove an earlier point made in my first storybook that I live a lifetime about every 10 years. Every day brings a fresh story. The only question is whether I see it or not. I trust that as you read these to yourself or to others, that you will recall your own stories that carry a point worth noting and grow. Markers. I'm sorry to have to confess this, but there have been two people in my life whom I hated. They were both uncles. One of them was named Raymond, and the other one was named Austin. Now, the problem with hatred is that it binds the hater and not the hated. Hatred is a miserable set of chains that God will not leave alone in the hearts of His children. When you struggle with such emotions, you often avoid beneficial interaction. I avoided the Lord's Prayer. Oh, it was mostly great, except for that one line, "Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us." Ouch! Raymond and Austin kept popping into my mind. Also, when you're in the midst of struggle, you avoid, as I did, certain passages of Scripture that you know will speak to you. You know where they are, and you leave them alone, conveniently limiting yourself to the Psalms, where David seemed so adept at expressing strong emotions about his enemies. But sometimes you read the Scripture accidentally. Love your enemies. Aye. Do good to those who despitefully use you. Oh. Pray for your enemies. Ouch. I knew I had to do it. Pray for them, that is. But I must also admit that my early praying was not very mature. God, you said vengeance was yours, you would repay. Get 'em. But God would not let me get away with that, and I knew I had to pray the kind of prayer for them that I would want prayed for me. So I prayed, Father, really bless them. Draw them to you and fill them with the knowledge of you and your will. You see, Austin had been the first of the Irwins to really follow the Lord, but he had drifted away, and his third state was worse than his first. Raymond also had grown cold in his relationship with the Lord. I continued, bless them so much that they cannot even contain it. Overwhelm them with your goodness. Prosper them. He did. They both returned to an intense relationship with the Lord, and there was a family reconciliation that could occur only at the loving hands of God. It was wonderful. But throughout the time of praying, I noticed that I no longer hated them. In fact, to my amazement, I grew to actually love them. I knew that was God. Now I could repeat the Lord's Prayer without hitch and without faces popping into my mind. Well, at this point, I thought the story was over, but it wasn't. You see, as a graduating senior from college, I made a dumb decision. Now, this was neither my first nor my last dumb decision. But I decided that now, called by God, I, with my wife and our one-year-old daughter, Gloria, would head out across America teaching in churches. Now, there isn't a great demand for a kid fresh out of college to teach. What I'm trying to say is that I was largely unemployed. At one time of great need, who would come to my rescue but Raymond? Gail, I need help on my farm. You can plow for me and help me care for the equipment. I'll pay you, give you a place for your family to stay, and you can eat at my table. I'll take care of you until somebody wants you. I thought, what an incredible symbol of God's grace to me that it should be Raymond who would save my life. You did this, didn't you, God?
Yep.
I thought so. Well, I thought the story was over, but it wasn't. My father, after years of disability from his airplane accident, died in the late 1970s. 2 years later, my mother married again. I performed the wedding and at the close wanted to say, I now pronounce you Mom and Dad. She married one of the finest persons I have ever met, a man so like Jesus that I marvel. His name happens to be Raymond. Again, I thought, this is incredible, God. Now you've given me a person whom I love and respect and even call him Dad, and his name is Raymond. What a symbol of your reconciliation in my life. You did this, didn't you?
Yep.
I thought so. Well, I thought the story was over, but it wasn't. You see, there's still Austin. We had been reconciled, but he moved to northwestern Arkansas, and I had not seen him for years. I didn't even know how to get in touch with him. As it happened, I spoke in a northwest Arkansas church one Sunday. I didn't expect Austin to be there. I didn't know how to get in touch with him and didn't know if he even knew I was around. But when I stood up to speak, there he was sitting near the back. I could not believe it. He had never before heard me teach. When I finished, we made a beeline to each other. I can still feel the bear hug. We were brothers. All that was past was past. A few weeks after that meeting, Austin died. Well, I thought the story was over, but it wasn't. You see, in 1989, my oldest daughter, Gloria, gave birth to her fourth child, a son, whom she named Austin Gale. I couldn't believe it. As I held that handsome, intelligent, outstanding young man, I couldn't help but think, this is incredible, God. Here in my grandson, I have an ultimate symbol of your grace and reconciliation. Now our names are placed together, Austin Gale. You did this, didn't you?
Yep,
I thought so. You see, when Gloria named him, she did not know the story that I have related to you here. So a few months after his birth, I said, sit down, honey, I have a story to tell you. I told her the story you have just heard. She cried and said, Daddy, I didn't know. I know, honey. That's what makes this so wonderful. This is God. Well, I thought the story was over, but it wasn't. You see, 6 months later, I presented Austin Gale to the Lord in dedication at the church my daughter and her family attended. As I held Austin, I stated to the congregation, all dedications are wonderful, but there's a special story about this dedication that you need to hear. I related the story to them, and at the close, something dawned on me. Standing 3 paces to my left was my stepdad, Raymond. He and my mother had flown out for this event. I realized that he had never heard his story. So I continued, there's another story here that you need to hear. I told them Raymond's story. When I finished, we were like melted cheese all over the floor. I continued, now you can see what God does when you surrender your life to Him. He finds the chains in your life, breaks them, then fills your life with markers, symbols, altars, memorials to remind you of His grace. Well, I thought the story was over, but it isn't. Questions. 1. What spiritual breakthroughs can you relate? 2. Describe a family reconciliation you have had or one you wish you had. Coffee and Angels. At my first pastorate, an elderly retired preacher served as one of my favorite people and staunchest supporters. His background in the denomination of his past was highly legalistic. They had preached against coffee, doctors, and just about anything else. However, this brother was a few steps beyond that because of his gentle spirit and his relationship with God. He told me that he preached against drinking coffee, an official position, by the way, of his denomination, until one night he dreamed of dying and going to heaven. He described it as incredibly beautiful, with angels walking around everywhere. And then with a smile he said, every angel he saw had a cup of coffee in his hand. Well, after that he never preached against coffee. Often when I would call a special prayer meeting, only Brother Holland would show up, so he and I would pray together. One prayer that flowed from his gentle spirit scared me. I lacked the freedom to pray that prayer. He would pray, God, if I'm going to damage any of your children or hurt any of your little lambs, just kill me now and take me home. I envied his prayer, but I lacked his bravery. Questions. How would you describe your bravest prayer? 2. What rules have changed in your life because of new insight? Coffee and Orphans. 6 weeks after the overthrow of the vicious Ceausescu government in Romania, I joined a team of people taking a truckload of supplies into that country. It was my most direct people-to-people experience in an outright communist country. Although they were now free, they did not know how to act in freedom. In each town that we stayed, we were quizzed and treated like suspicious people, simply because that was the way they were trained to treat all outsiders. Ceausescu was so paranoid that he destroyed all means of communication among the people. It was illegal to have a copying machine or a typewriter. Having a telephone made you a source of suspicion, as would any form of travel. His dreaded secret police kept everyone in terror. We could travel only as far into the country as our supply of gasoline would permit, since no lead-free gasoline existed there. Brasov was our turnaround point for delivering supplies, and we headed out with our last stop planned in the city of Arad. Unable to find the intended person for our final drop of supplies, our leader said there was an orphanage in the same town we could visit. This was a state-run orphanage that happened to have a Christian as the director. And she was a very educated person who held a high position in the country until she refused to denounce her faith. So Ceausescu relegated her to what amounted to a work Siberia, directing an orphanage. Sadly, these orphanages, like their hospitals, had almost no supplies. The rooms were stark and the toys were absent. Ceausescu demanded that his people have children, and that demand resulted in large, unsupportable families with many abandoned babies. Ceausescu himself would use the blood of babies to give himself youth-producing transfusions. Our visit to the orphanage was highly welcomed by the director and the staff as we toured the building. My heart was torn by sympathy for the children and disgust at Ceausescu. At the close of our tour, the director brought us back to her office and treated us to a cup of coffee. We all looked at each other and exclaimed, "Coffee!" We knew that coffee was like gold in that country. It virtually did not exist. We inquired. With a little embarrassment, she told us that, well, she had been saving the coffee to give a cup to each staff member as a Christmas present. Remember, this was February. but they were so delighted to have us there, they wanted to give us their best. You can imagine how we felt as we held their best in our hands and sipped. Then we looked at each other and our faces lit up. We remembered that supplies still remained in our truck and that under the front seat was 6 pounds of coffee. Hey, we had a party giving that to the director of the orphanage. I couldn't help but remember the words of Jesus, "Give, and it will be given to you." Questions. Have you ever been given great hospitality when you knew it was very costly to the giver? Describe it. 2. Has anyone ever thought you were an angel because you did something amazing for them? Tell about it. Turning points. Subhead. Why is he mad at me? A child too young to read delivered one of my greatest lessons. Forgive me, but I choose not to describe my early style of speaking, but I will tell you of a change that occurred. A local family in South Louisiana visited our church one Sunday. Because of their background, it was a remarkable event. The family included several small children. Some days later, from a mutual friend, I heard something that shook me and changed me deeply. On the way home, the 4-year-old daughter of the visiting family asked her mother a question. "Why was that man mad at me?" "Oh, he wasn't mad at you." "Yes, he was." "Why was he mad at me?" "He wasn't mad at you. Why do you think that?" "Well, if he wasn't mad at me, then why did he yell at me like that?" My heart was grieved when I heard that. It changed me. I never want a child to leave my presence and think that in the name of Jesus I was mad at them. Subhead, I don't understand a thing. I was attending a local university to complete my master's degree and at the same time serving as pastor of a church. At the close of the service, I habitually stood at the back and greeted people as they left. One precious elder saint who had been part of the church for 60 years and whom I loved and appreciated approached me to say goodbye. "Pastor, we love you so much." "Thank you." "You're so eloquent. We love to hear you preach." "Thank you." I was loving this. "But Pastor..." "Yes?" "I don't understand a word you say." I gulped as she continued. "We know you are intelligent and that you go to the university, and we're proud of that. But you use these long university words, and I don't understand a word you say." I thanked her for telling me and then went home and licked my wounds as I realized that I had fallen into the trap of arrogance and ego. I pledged to make myself understandable to anyone, children as well as little old ladies and men. Questions. 1. Name 2 people who have influenced your life and tell how they did. 2. What have been some specific turning points in your life? That's my God. Ezekiel Guti thanked me profusely for taking him to Universal Studios theme park in California. Guti, founder of a very large organization of black churches in Zimbabwe, was not excited about the rides or other shows. He especially appreciated the knowledge of how they fooled our eyes and made things seem to be something that they were not. He explained, "My people are not sophisticated enough to know that this is trickery. They think that what they see on the movie screen is what actually happened. This is wonderful that I can go back and tell them the truth." I tell you this to introduce another event of great proportions. Another friend, Bruce Coble, went from Tennessee to Zimbabwe to serve as the director of Goody's Bible College. He became a much-loved person to the students. On one of his trips back to the United States, Bruce collected some of his favorite videotapes to take back and show to the students. The tapes included Hollywood's version of the Ten Commandments. The classic scene in the movie is the parting of the Red Sea. Bruce found it difficult to tell me this story without choking up with tears, but he said that when the students saw that depiction on the screen, as far as they knew, the camera was actually there recording the scene. They got so excited, they were all standing in their seats shouting, "That's my God! That's my God!" Such straightforward love of God. Questions. 1. How do you feel about media attempts to portray Bible miracles? 2. When do you get the most excited about God? Birth. The birth of a baby is such an awesome thing. Every couple must wonder at each birth, will everything be okay? Will the baby be healthy? Can our combined bodies produce something good? Anxious moments accompany every birth. Our first three children, all daughters, provided much joy for us, and I would have been a totally happy man, but my wife and I decided to have our final child when we reached age 30. I confess that as a man I desired to have a son. However, I would have still been deliriously happy with another daughter. The time came for the delivery. Now, my wife delivers children rather rapidly, and I was glad that we lived just 5 minutes from the hospital. I waited those anxious moments. Modern times, with the husband assisting the wife in the delivery room, had not yet arrived. Hospitals still then considered husbands just next to leprosy, so I waited a safe distance away, but close enough to observe the action of the birthing department. At the moment that I expected our child to be born, I noticed a flurry of activity that obviously came from near panic. My anxiety increased and I began to pray in new ways. Now I was building a new plane of acceptance with the Lord in terms of our child. If there were dangers to life or health, I would accept and grow with that. However, I prayed that it would not be so. If there were dangers to my wife, I would accept that, but again, I prayed that it was not so. Long moments left me in my state of anxiety and my prayer. Then finally the news came that our healthy son had been born. Only then, on inquiry, did I find that the tragedy belonged to someone else, as their baby had just died. I accepted our new joy with some mixed feelings. I also discovered that some of that activity came from the nurses moving about looking for materials to make flags in the delivery room, since our son Clyde was born on Flag Day. Nonetheless, I pondered for some time my resolution with God during that anxious time. Questions. 1. Describe the tensions and anxieties you experience in having a child or a sibling. 2. How do you accept your own genetic difficulties? Black Market. There once existed two very powerful radio stations just over the Texas border in Mexico. Whatever else they broadcast, late at night, various indescribable religious programming ruled and reached most of the central USA. Often when I had finished my nighttime studies in college and was winding down for bed, I would turn on one of those stations just for the grins. One particular speaker regaled us with his prowess. I write it here as I heard it. Quote, "I have the gift of prophecy. I know everything. Just write me and ask me. I know the secret of the hydrogen bomb." I thought, well, you know everything except the English you speak. Another broadcaster's story on that station requires a little background. One of the tent evangelists of the 1950s purchased a place in Arizona and named it Miracle Valley. Now, these were the days of "Can You Top This?" So another evangelist, a woman, decided to buy a place that she named Miracle Mountain. I enjoyed listening to her because I knew what was going on and it gave me a few extra chuckles. She, too, claimed prophetic inspiration and would make LP recordings of her prophecies, which you could have by enclosing an offering to, of course, keep her on the air. Now I need to give you a little more background. Some who read this have no idea what an LP is. Well, that's what we called a long-playing record. Perhaps in this CD world, you don't even know what a record is. Well, the audio technical world progressed from flat 12-inch discs with grooves on them in which a needle would rest as the disc revolved at 78 revolutions per minute. The disc stage was a 7-inch one that revolved at 45 revolutions per minute. Finally, audio perfection seemed to have come in the 33 1/3 RPM long play that carried much higher fidelity. Forgive me for what seems an unnecessary explanation, but there's a reason. Long play connoisseurs knew that for some strange reason, in the pressing of the records, one could hear occasionally at the very beginning a phantom image of the sound just before the actual recording began. Now, knowing that, let's return to Our Lady Evangelist. One of the records of the prophecies she offered over the air apparently had that ghost image flaw in it when the pressing was completed. Here is how she handled it. Quote, "If you'll send me an offering, I'll send you this special recording of prophecies just for you. At the beginning, if you will listen closely, you'll hear the voice of Jesus as he begins to tell me what to say." Close quotes. Enough. Bedtime. Questions. Have you ever watched or listened to any religious programming simply because you couldn't believe it? Give an instance. Number two, describe any religious competitiveness you have observed. Weddings. The bride plans to the finest detail to ensure that her wedding proceeds flawlessly. However, flawless weddings are immensely forgettable. The little hitches, the laughable moments, are the items talked about into the future and are the triggers that bring recall of the event. But no, and I emphasize no, bride ever plans the glitches. Yet I can assure you that glitches always happen. They may not always be obvious to the audience, and they may not have happened publicly, but they always happen. Two events stand out in my own memory of weddings with glitches that could never have been planned. One happened to a friend, and I let you hear it first. The lisp. After years of difficult and slow productivity of ministry in a pastorate, God had given a harvest of local people to this pastor friend of mine. About 6 months after this revival, the pastor was performing a wedding in the parsonage between a young lady who had grown up in his church and a man who was a newcomer product of the revival. Before I go on, I must tell you that my pastor friend, a giant of a man physically and spiritually, speaks with a slight lisp that varies in intensity. Friends and family surrounded the couple as the pastor proceeded with the ceremony. At one point, he instructed the man to clasp hands. Unfortunately, the pastor's lisp changed clasp enough that the misunderstanding groom, unaccustomed to these new ways, began to clap his hands. The pastor, a bit flustered by it all, knew that the bride would understand, so he attempted to correct it by telling her to clasp hands. She misunderstood also and began to clap her hands. By now, the pastor realized that if you can't whip them, join them. So he laid his Bible down and began to clap his hands and loudly praise the Lord. The crowd joined in, and after this brief happy moment when the pastor quit clapping, everybody quit. Then he took up his Bible and continued the ceremony to the end. No counseling. I didn't recognize the voice on the phone asking me if I performed weddings. I responded positively, but told the female caller that I required at least 3 hours of counseling prior to the ceremony. After what seemed to be a long pause, she responded that they would do that, so I began to question further. My first question was, How old are you? She responded, 65. Forget the counseling, I replied. I was only 25 anyway. What could I tell her? When she identified herself, I realized that she was the vegetable farmer who lived a distance away and managed to come to church only about once a month. I remembered that she was a widow. Well, the ceremony was scheduled to occur at her sister's house in the town where I lived. The day arrived. I knocked on the door of her sister's house, and she excitedly answered and invited me in. Then she hollered out each side of the house to neighbors who came over to be the legal witnesses, as required in that state. She then yelled out of the back door into a large plowed field. A lone figure was working about 200 yards away. The worker, about 70 years old, walked in, brushed the dust off his overalls, and the groom was now ready for the wedding. The ceremony was uneventful, except that the bride misunderstood when I said to take his right hand. She thought I said to shake his right hand, so she pumped it vigorously. When the ceremony was over, I discovered that the bride and I were the only literate people present. I had to sign for the witnesses and for the groom. I chuckled at the situation, not knowing that this day would bring about an additional story. And we'll get to that under What Will $2 Get? Questions. If you are married, what went wrong during your ceremony that you still vividly remember? Do you remember that event better than the ceremony itself? 2. How would you design the perfect wedding? Benevolent Robbery. Subtitle, I Can Cook. On my first trip to Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, my relationship with the national black people suffered a strain or two. As I walked along, they insisted on carrying my briefcase or my Bible for me. Being a capable American and a person who opposed seeing them as slaves or underlings, I resisted this service as firmly as I could. Often I succeeded, often I failed. In my insensitivity, I failed to notice their fallen faces when I succeeded. I remembered thinking that I was teaching them a thing or two about Americans and how I viewed them as I resisted. They silently accepted. The following year, I returned, accompanied by a pastor friend, to teach at a leadership conference. They pitched a large meeting tent in a church campground and lodged my friend and me in a very nice cabin. One of the ladies cooked breakfast for us in the kitchen of the cabin. After only one day of this, we, as capable American guys, informed her that she need not return the next day. We could make our own breakfast and let her sleep later in the mornings. On the next morning, we cooked, and the lady did not return. At lunch the next day, I detected a distance and aloofness that had changed from the day before. I mentioned to the wife of the leader, "I guess you know we made our own breakfast this morning." She nodded, somewhat icily. Immediately I knew this must be pursued. Is that a problem? Yes. What kind of problem is it? If you don't let us cook your breakfast for you, you're robbing us of a blessing. Well, please tell her we want her to come back tomorrow. Okay. Now that the air was cleared, everyone brightened and conversation flowed. Now, when people approached me to carry my Bible or my briefcase, I quickly smiled and relented. Subtitle, Don't Be Stingy. One other area of my cultural thinking waited to slap me around. At the time I first visited Zimbabwe, the white people could hire a full-time black worker to handle the yard and other exterior household duties for $35 a month, and could hire another person, usually a lady, to cook and care for the interior of the house for another $35. For that paltry sum, a person of any means at all could live a luxurious and easy life. Now, I bristled at this and considered this lifestyle to be taking advantage of the local people. I mentioned to the black leader that if I lived here, I would not hire someone at that wage. I would take care of my household myself. He did not answer. By now, I had learned that such silence spoke volumes and decided I would chase this thought. How would you feel about a white person living here and doing his own work? His answer? We would think he was stingy. Why is that? Well, we understand that you have a lot more money than we do, and it does not bother us, but we need the work. If you don't hire us, then we're unemployed. We know you can afford to hire us, so if you don't, we think you're stingy. Another of my pet arrogances crashed. Questions. To what degree can you let people do things for you that you're capable of doing yourself? 2. What customs of foreign countries or foreigners in your country have you found surprising or intriguing? What are you trying to teach me? I scooted along on the icy Missouri freeway in our new van, just purchased from a cousin's dealership. Our kids chose to ride home with me while my wife Ada drove the old car, which we intended to sell on the open market. As we drove along, I constantly monitored Ada in the rearview mirror, making sure she was okay and following along. As I reached the bottom of a long slope, I glanced in the mirror and could not see her. I slowed down to see if she would catch up. She didn't. I pulled off and looked back. I entered the world of shock. On top of the hill behind us, her overturned car lay on its roof in the middle of the highway with smoke and steam billowing out. I instructed the kids to stay in the van while I raced the half mile back up to the car. Each step was a death step to me. My heart pounded. Along the way, questions raced through my mind. What did I do wrong that this is happening to me? Where have I not been faithful? Did I fail to pay my tithe somewhere? Have my thoughts been out of control? What are you trying to teach me? All these questions remained unresolved as I raced along. They simply hung there, haunting me. As I neared the top of the hill, I looked up and saw Ada standing out beside the road. I raced to embrace her and check, "Are you okay?" She was totally unhurt except for glass slivers in her hands. So I did learn something. I learned that my questions were totally irrelevant. Questions. When has something happened to you that caused you to ask why? 2. What do you think God requires of you in order to bless you? What does the grace of God mean to you? Office walls. The walls around my cubicle came about neck high. Status, not efficiency, dictated that. I worked on the headquarters staff of a denomination developing magazines for the youth department. I quickly learned after I arrived that one's status could be determined by the height of his wall. Secretaries had no wall at all. The next level up, the lowest executives, had walls neck high. The director of a department, such as the youth department, had walls that came within a foot or so of the ceiling. However, their walls were the same material as mine. The executive over several departments had walls all the way to the ceiling. However, they were made of the same material as mine. Finally, when you reach the highest level of executive, one not only had walls to the ceiling made of normal frame wall material, but he also had carpet. Now the status was dependent upon where the office was located in relationship to the number one guy and the actual size of the office. When a school was built onto the headquarters building, it was discovered at the completion of the building that the headmaster of the new school would have an office with 10 square feet more than the top executive. Many thousands of dollars were spent to reduce the size of that office so protocol would not be violated. Ah, but back to my own walls. A friend of mine said they wanted to give me walls appropriate to my status, but they felt I would keep tripping over them. Questions. Describe some status symbols that you observe on your job. 2, what symbols of position or achievement do... Catastrophe. The scene, an upscale Los Angeles suburban house. The characters, a retired couple. They awaken to the sound of a kitten crying. The crying continued throughout their early morning coffee, disturbing them enough to check it out. He discovered that a kitten had climbed the tip of a tree in their yard and could not get down. They knew they couldn't leave it crying there, so emergency procedures took over. Not being milk drinkers, they rushed to buy a quart and placed a saucer full at the base of the tree to lure the kitten. The crying continued. The cat stayed. Next, he placed a ladder against the tree and climbed to the top of the ladder. Unfortunately, the tree was a fairly young one and could not support his weight at the top to reach the kitten. Discouraged, they sat down and pondered what to do next as the crying continued. "Ah, I know," he exclaimed. "Remember when we were kids in school and we read about the fire department coming and rescuing cats from trees? Well, let's call the fire department." An unsympathetic voice answered, "Look, this is Los Angeles. We don't get cats down from trees. That occurs only in the country. You'll have to get the cat down by yourself." Discouraged further, they returned to another cup of coffee and the miserable sound of this kitten crying. Then enlightenment. "I know what to do. Honey," the man said, "I will climb the ladder as high as I can against the tree and tie a rope. Then I'll attach the other end of the rope to the bumper of the car. And since this is a young and supple tree, it should bend easily as I back up the car. You can get on the hood, and when the tree's low enough, retrieve the cat." It worked. The tree bent nicely, and just as the lady reached up to get the cat, the rope broke. Meow! That cat was launched. I guess this is where the word catapult comes from, or perhaps catastrophe. They had no idea where the cat was pulled. Now they sat feeling worse than before about what they had done to the poor kitty. Well, several days later, while at the grocery store, they encountered a recently widowed neighbor from several houses away. They noticed that she was buying cat food. "We didn't know you had a cat." "Well, I didn't until just a few days ago. You know, I've been so lonely since my husband died, and I was out in the backyard praying, 'God, should I buy a dog or a cat to help keep me company?' When out of the sky, this cat fell right into my yard." Questions. Have you ever seen God accomplish something and it appeared that he might have been also having fun? 2, have you ever had something seem to go wrong but turned out so right? Seeds of Revolution. Subtitle, If the Truth Were Known. My second visit to Africa delivered almost more revelation and disillusionment than I was prepared to handle. At the time, Rhodesia, later changed to Zimbabwe, suffered deeply from a long civil war. The 250,000 white people were fighting hard to stay in power and keep the 8 million blacks from ruling the country. The fly in the ointment was the backing of the black cause by communist China. The white government, with freer access to the Western press, fully exploited this communist backing in seeking favor and support from the rest of the world. The honesty and openness of a handful of knowing people in the country handed me a mountain of awesome and devastating knowledge. One black leader informed me that Africa could never be communist. He said, "Africans believe in God. Communism doesn't." He informed me that they can never take our belief away. Also, he said, "We Africans invented communal living, so communists have nothing to teach us in that area." Then he dropped the bombshell on me. We love the United States and sought your help to gain freedom in our revolution, just as you had in yours, but you turned us down. The Chinese and Russians were only too glad to help us, and we had to have help. Our cost for this is that you consider us to be communists like them. I then began to see the power of publicity connections. The white government gave glowing accounts in press releases of their Christian leaning, while warning us that if the blacks won, the Bible would no longer be taught in schools. What they did not tell us was that there were no schools for blacks except those schools provided by missionaries. Government information suppliers further advertised that on Friday nights they had a required prayer meeting for their military troops. We Americans, of course, were impressed with that. From the lips of a white person, I learned the truth about that prayer meeting on Friday nights. It was not a prayer meeting at all, but instead a strip show to entertain the troops. But that obviously could not be related to the press. But let's return to the school situation. After the war and the black government was in power, I observed two things, one of them devastating, the other thrilling. First, the devastating. After speaking one Sunday at a church in a township, which is a large black settlement, but generally not on maps, and as we drove back to where I was staying, we passed a building surrounded by a high barbed wire fence. The building was brick and windowless. Outside the fence, women gathered as if waiting to go inside. A policeman or two wandered among the women. Immediately, I recognized what this had to be, a prison. I simply remarked to my friends in the car that I guess you have to have prisons in Zimbabwe also. Hesitantly and with embarrassment, they corrected me. No, Brother Gale, this is a beer hall. They're all over the country. In the past, the government supplied us with very cheap beer to keep us drunk and happy. When drunkenness is involved, violence breaks out, and they just lock us in like a prison to let us fight it out. These women are here trying to get their husbands out and save their homes. Well, now, under the new government, we're converting these halls to schools since we don't have any school buildings. But this one is still a beer hall. Well, now the thrilling. A year later, I took two friends from California with me to see what was happening in the country. One was a school teacher, anxious to see what the schools would be like under this new communist government. I told them not to make too many prejudgments. I encouraged them to simply drop in on a school and spend a few hours. They were welcomed. When they returned, they could not contain themselves. They told me every class hour began with Bible reading and prayer and sometimes a devotional for the whole school over the intercom, they informed me. I smiled and joked, I guess they're not as advanced as we are in the United States. Subtitle, Fruit of Apartheid. The scene in South Africa was equally as difficult. I shall never forget a time when a leading black Christian sought my counsel. He said, a major Christian organization has asked me to come to work for them, and I'd really love to do it, but I don't know if I can afford it. Well, I replied, why is that? Is the pay a lot lower than what you're making on your job now? Oh, no, he said, the pay is much better, but I would lose 9 years. Lose 9 years? What do you mean? Well, here in South Africa, blacks are not permitted to purchase a home until they've been working for the same employer for 10 years. Well, I've been working with this employer for 9 years, and if I change jobs, I have to start all over. But I said, if you can't purchase a home, what do you do? Where do you live? Well, he said, the employers provide dormitories for the men, but the wives have to stay back in the homelands. The men have to be away from their wives most of the time. It's a very difficult situation and causes a lot of problems. Well, my heart broke. Over and over, the words of Jesus rang in my ears. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to set at liberty those who are oppressed. Questions. What things do you know that you would like to shout from the housetops? 2. When do you feel the press has lied to you or misrepresented news? May I pretend? As an assistant pastor overwhelmed by the counseling load, I gathered my most frequent visitors into a small home fellowship to increase the spiritual dynamics that bring healing. Among those in attendance was a young lady convinced by the constant assurance of prior church experience that she was demon-possessed, who struggled with her sexual identity and who wrapped all of this in a body afflicted with cerebral palsy. She, others, and I joined, making our home fellowship very interesting. Occasionally, Martha, not her real name, by the way, would wander off into a sinful situation, then defiantly call me on the phone and tell me where she was. Then she would ask, "What do you think of me now?" I would always assure her that though she knew how I felt about what she was doing, I still loved her, and this broke my heart. She would go silent and then hang up the phone. In spite of these moments, so many wonderful things happened in her life that her husband asked if he could join our home fellowship. He felt that the group could help him with some abiding problems in his life. We welcomed him. Martha still had far to go. Her fuse burned hot and quick. When it reached the powder of her agitation, she would blow up and read the riot act to me and describe me in ways my mother would not appreciate. Her temper was simply one of the many things she struggled with while never losing her faith in God. She added to the adventure of my life as I rejoiced in the degree of her growth. After I left her city to take another assignment in the kingdom, I had no further contact with her until the pastor of the church called me fairly early one morning. Martha had entered a major hospital for heart surgery, and the pastor traveled to be with her. When he arrived and greeted her, she asked him if he minded if she pretended that he was Gail Irwin. He smiled and said, "Go ahead." Immediately she exploded and added him to the list of those whose mothers would not appreciate the commentary. When she finished, she thanked him and said, "I needed that." When they wheeled her into the operating room, he immediately called me and related the story. Well, sometimes I guess being chewed out can be a good thing. Questions. What difficult relationships have you had that worked out to be very profitable? 2. How do you feel when someone loses their temper and calls you bad things?